The walk to the timber mill took 40 minutes along the river road, and Wren counted each one. She had told Silas she was visiting the florist on High Street, for Lily's Thomas Mercer's anniversary was approaching, and she preferred to select the arrangements herself rather than leave it to the shop girl. It was a small lie, the kind her father had told without thinking, the kind that felt like lying only because she was telling it now, with the knowledge of what else her father had lied about. The morning had cleared to a pale, washed-out blue, the kind of sky that suggested rain had fallen sometime during the night but had decided against returning. Wren wore her father's old overcoat, the charcoal wool one he kept hanging by the parlor door for customers who came in winter. It smelled faintly of hemp tobacco and camphor, and something she could not identify, something that made her throat tight when she caught it unexpectedly. She pulled the collar higher against the chill. Oak Haven lay behind her now, the funeral home's gable end disappearing around the bend, followed by the row of shops on Market Street, the church tower, the water tower with its rusted skeleton. Ahead, the river road narrowed and the buildings thinned, giving way to fields and hedgerows, and then, finally, to the industrial strip that ran along the eastern bank of the Oak. She had passed these buildings 100 times without really seeing them. The timber mill occupied the largest parcel-a sprawling complex of brick and corrugated iron, its chimneys dark since the owner had died 2 years ago and his sons had taken the business to Derbyshire, where rents were cheaper and the timber was fresher. But the mill was not empty. Smoke still rose from one of the stacks, thin and gray, and the sound of machinery reached her before she saw the building itself a low, grinding thrum that vibrated in her teeth. Wren slowed her pace. She stood at the edge of the yard and looked. The complex was larger than she had imagined. 3 main buildings formed an L-shape around a central courtyard, their brick walls stained with decades of soot and rain. The nearest building housed the sawmill proper, the great iron wheel still turned, driven by a water channel that diverted from the river. Sawdust lay everywhere, piled in drifts along the gutters, coated the ground in a pale yellow powder that crunched beneath her boots. The air smelled of fresh-cut wood, sharp and resinous, undercut by something darker, a chemical tang that made her nose wrinkle. She stepped closer. The courtyard was cluttered with stacks of lumber, some freshly cut and pale, others weathered to silver gray. A steam engine sat idle beside the main building, its boiler cold, its flywheel still. Beyond it, behind a fence of rusted wire, she could see the crematory's chimney, the one attached to the funeral home, not this one. The timber mill's chimney was separate, taller, and older. Wren approached the nearest building. The door was open, a gap wide enough for a man to walk through, but not wide enough for a cart. She hesitated, then pushed it wider with her shoulder and stepped inside. The interior was vast and dim, light filtering through grime-caked windows high on the brick walls. The floor was covered in sawdust, thick and deep, muffling her footsteps. She could see the sawmill machinery in the center of the space, the great circular blade, the conveyor belts, the rollers that fed timber through. All of it was still. But along the far wall, in a section cordoned off by a low brick partition, she saw movement. A man stood at a workbench, his back to her, bent over something she could not see. He wore a canvas apron stained dark with grease, and his sleeves were rolled to the elbow, revealing forearms dusted with pale powder. Beside him, on a shelf, sat a row of burlap sacks, their openings tied with twine. One of them had split at the seam, and a trickle of fine gray ash leaked from it onto the floor. Wren stopped breathing for a moment. The ash was the color of wood smoke, but finer than anything she had seen from a fireplace. It lay on the floor in a thin, uniform layer, almost like flour. She knelt and touched it with her fingertip. It was warm. "You're not supposed to be in here," the man said, without turning around. Wren rose slowly. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to intrude." The man turned. He was older than she expected, 50, maybe 55, with a face that had been handsome once and had since been worn down by something, the way stone gets worn down by water. His eyes were pale, almost colorless, and they studied her with a kind of tired curiosity. "You're the Holloway girl," he said, "not a question. Wren, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"Your father used to send men out here. Every week, sometimes twice a week. They'd load these sacks," he nodded toward the burlap bags on the shelf, "and take them back to the crematory." Wren's pulse quickened. "Take them for what?" The man wiped his hands on his apron and leaned back against the workbench. Ash, mill ash, fine powder from the sawdust collected and sifted. Your father bought it by the sack. For the furnaces. No, love, not for the furnaces. He smiled, but it didn't reach his eyes. For the urns. The word landed like a stone in still water. Ren felt the surface of things tilt, just slightly, the way the floor had seemed to tilt in her father's office when she read the ledger entry for Arthur Gable. I don't understand, she said. The man shrugged. I don't understand it either. I just make the stuff. Your father or the boy he sent, the one with the loose tie and the rolled-up sleeves, he paused, considering, then nodded as if the memory had settled into place. Selah's, was it? He'd come out, inspect the sacks, check the fineness of the powder with his fingers. If it was too coarse, he'd send it back. If it was right, he'd pay and take it away. What for? Ren pressed. What does mill ash go in an urn for? The man looked at her for a long moment. Something flickered across his face, pity or recognition or both. I've asked that question myself, miss, more than once, but I'm just the miller. I cut the wood, I collect the dust, I don't ask where it goes. He tapped the workbench with one finger. But I'll tell you this, the stuff your father bought wasn't sawdust. Not exactly. It was the residue from the boilers. The burners. The things that went into the fire and came out the other side as powder. Fine as flour, light as air. Ren felt the air leave her lungs. What goes into the boilers? The man's expression shifted. The tired curiosity hardened into something else, caution, or fear, or the simple instinct of a man who understood that some questions were better left unanswered. Wood, he said flatly. Coal, occasionally other refuse. I don't sort it. I just tend the fire. The man's expression shifted. He took a half step back, his hand drifting to the edge of the workbench, fingers finding purchase on the rough wood. Wood, he said flatly. Coal, occasionally other refuse. I do not sort it. I merely tend the fire. Can I see the boiler room? She asked. The man's jaw tightened. That's not part of the tour, miss. I'm not on a tour. She stepped closer, past the low brick partition, past the workbench, toward the corridor that led deeper into the building. My father was Elias Halloway. I run the funeral home now. I have a right to know what kind of materials he was buying. The man followed her, his footsteps heavy on the sawdust-covered floor. You have a right to ask questions, miss, but not all answers are yours to hear. They reached a heavy iron door set into the brick wall. The man put his hand on the handle and paused. The boiler room's not open to visitors. Your father knew that. He never asked to come in himself. Ren looked at the door. It was old, painted over so many times that the paint had built up into ridges along the edges. A small brass plate was affixed to it, the lettering worn almost unreadable. Boiler house, authorized personnel only. Open it, she said. The man shook his head. I can't do that. Then I'll open it myself. She reached for the handle. The man caught her wrist. His grip was firm but not brutal, and his eyes held hers with an intensity that surprised her. Miss Halloway, he said, and his voice had changed. Gone was the tired curiosity. In its place was something colder, more measured. Some things you're better off not knowing. Your father understood that. Maybe you should too. Ren looked at his hand on her wrist, then up at his face. She thought of Selah's, of how he had polished the brass fixtures in the foyer while telling her to stick to routine duties, of how his eyes had flicked away when she asked about the secondary archive room. She thought of her father, dead 6 months, his ledger open on her desk, his handwriting neat and precise and full of lies. She pulled her wrist free. I'm not my father, she said. The man released her. He stood there for a moment, studying her, then stepped aside. Ren turned the handle. The door opened with a groan of rusted hinges, and a wave of heat hit her face dry and acrid, carrying the scent of burnt wood and something else, something metallic and sour that made her stomach turn. She stepped inside. The boiler room was smaller than she expected, a single chamber dominated by a massive iron furnace that ran the length of the far wall. The coals had been banked but not extinguished. A dull, bruised glow persisted beneath a layer of gray dust, casting a sickly amber light across the brick surfaces. The heat was intense, pressing against her skin like a physical weight. Along the walls, rows of iron grates held piles of material coal, yes, but also wood, and something that looked like bone fragments, bleached white and cracked, mixed in with the blackened remnants of what might have been furniture or clothing or something else entirely. Ren approached the furnace. She knelt beside the grate and reached out, stopping just short of touching the pile. The bone fragments were small, broken, and unmistakable. They had been burned thoroughly, completely but not finely enough to be ash. They were the residue of something that had been heated and then left to cool, scraped from the firebox and dumped here, in the corner of a boiler room that no visitor was supposed to enter. She felt her hands shake. She closed them into fists to stop it. Behind her, the man said quietly, "That's what comes out the other side. What doesn't burn clean, what gets swept from the flue and dumped in the corner. Your father collected it, sifted it through screens until it was fine enough for an urn, called it filler. Said it was indistinguishable from cremated remains to anyone who didn't know what to look for." Ren stood. She turned to face him. The heat made her eyes water, and she blinked rapidly, trying to keep the vision clear. "How long?" she asked. The man shrugged. "Longer than you'd think. Your father was first in here when I was a boy. He knew what he was doing, knew how to make it look right, made sure the ash was the color of bone, the texture of bone, the weight of bone. He was thorough. That's the thing about your father, he was thorough." Ren thought of the ledger, of the neat columns and the careful handwriting, of the payments from Birmingham that appeared alongside the cremation fees, payments that grew larger and more regular over the years. 47 bodies, Dr. Thorne had said, though she had not yet met him. 47 bodies sold to medical schools and replaced with mill ash. 47 urns sitting on mantelpieces in houses across Oakhaven, too light, perhaps, for what they contained. "Thank you," she said. The words felt inadequate, hollow, the way her father's words had been hollow when he spoke of dignity. The man nodded once, briefly, then turned and walked back toward the workroom. He did not look back. Ren stood in the boiler room for a long time, listening to the furnace breathe, feeling the heat press against her skin, watching the embers glow and fade and glow again. She thought of the walk back to the funeral home 40 minutes along the river road, past the fields and the hedgerows, and the town that had never suspected what sat in its parlors and its crematories and its urns. She thought of Mrs. Gable's letter, of the piece she slept in, of the ash that sat on her mantelpiece, too light, perhaps, for what it was supposed to contain. She turned and walked out of the boiler room, closing the iron door behind her with a click that echoed in the corridor like a lock engaging. Outside, the afternoon light was fading, the sky bruising toward evening. Ren pulled her father's coat tighter around her and began the walk home, her boots crunching on the sawdust-strewn ground, the scent of burning pine and wet rot clinging to her clothes, to her hair, to the inside of her nostrils. A smell she would not forget. A smell that would follow her back to the funeral home and into the office and onto the desk beside the open ledger, where she would sit and stare at the entry for Arthur Gable and wonder how many more names followed. And how many more urns sat on mantelpieces across Oakhaven, and how many more widows slept in peace built on a lie. The walk home took 40 minutes. She counted each one,